Hello and welcome back to another episode of the DD Geopolitics podcast. I am your host, Sarah, and your other host, Marat. I decided to wear my prison jumpsuit today to meet you guys halfway, all the haters that want to see me in prison.
Nice.
I'm here. Marat, how are you? How was your week?
I'm doing good. Thank you. Weekend's all right. It's just been, enjoying this fine weather, but, also pretty busy, at my job, but, other than that, doing well.
Lots of kind of interesting thing happen. I guess MAGA is, happy today. Trump and Ursula announced some sort of trade partnership. We're also going to get into a little bit of the Ukraine debacle. There were peace talks this week, if you can call them that. Israel, of course, needs an update. And then we will give you as much as we can about Thailand, Cambodia. Orange looks great on you. That's good. That's good. That's good to know. So when I do finally go to prison, I look like, what's her name from Orange is the New Black, the Laura Prepon girl. Alex, there we go. I'm Alex from Orange is the New Black. But yeah, and then we'll get into Thailand, Cambodia, which is actually an incredibly interesting and intricate conflict that's still ongoing despite Trump's Truth Social posts yesterday. So let's get started. We have, this is actually from today. Trump was with Ursula, pretty pitiful. So let's start with the clips.
I have a question for the EU Commission President. What are the U.S. concessions? What is the U.S. giving up in the deal, if anything?
So as the starting point was an imbalance, a surplus on our side and a deficit on the U.S. side. And we wanted to rebalance the trade relation. And we wanted to do it in a way that trade goes on between the two of us across the Atlantic, because the two biggest economies should have a good trade flow between us. And I think we hit exactly the point we wanted to find. Rebalance.
So we have that video, and this is also hilarious.
Mr. Trump, can you do better than 15% tariff rate for the EU?
Better meaning lower?
Yeah.
No. Mr. President, return to God.
So they ask Ursula, what concessions has the United States made? And she basically says none. We just started from a trade imbalance, and, we just want trade to continue. And Trump says it will not go lower than 15%, not even entertaining any nuance. Where does this leave Europe or the EU, I guess?
Well, following the trade talks and all these tariff deals and whatnot has been maddening, because he just lies like he breathes, right? And we initially had heard that all these countries are calling and begging for a deal. And then recently revealed that he still had not heard back from over 100 countries. So I just sort of I never listened to him anymore at this point. I mean, as you saw there in that video, as she's talking, she's like, well, it starts off with a surplus on our side and a deficit on theirs. And he's like,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if he knows what's happening anymore. I think we're in the Biden zone with him, but I'm not sure when he goes into these, he's aware of what's being said. He doesn't ever seem that interested in any of it.
No.
But, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're fine. These are the key terms of the trade deal. Obviously, United States has dictated the majority of all of the terms. Starting August 1st, it's 15% base tariff on all European goods entering the American market, which is a reversal from the EU's original goal of duty-free trade. A huge victory. This is a big victory for Trump. In exchange, the European Union has committed, this is so ridiculous, the European Union has committed to purchasing $750 billion of U.S. energy exports, including LNG and oil. Got to get them off that Russian teat, I guess. A White House statement boldly claimed the deal clarifies the rules of the game for European countries. That's a quote, an implicit message that the EU must now operate on under American defined trade terms. EU leaders who had hoped for a more balanced concessions are left with little to show. President Trump described the agreement as a way to prevent an escalation of trading disputes between the two world's two largest trading partners, but in reality, the deal cements the United States' upper hand. According to Ursula, EU countries are still purchasing too much Russian gas, and all oil products from Russia continue to enter through the back door. Trump has stated that the U.S. will supply NATO countries with military equipment, which they will then be able to transfer to Ukraine. So and, the EU really gets nothing.
Yeah, well, but further, I mean, this further cements, you know, the Atlantic relationship. And, you know, as we look broader, this only deepens kind of the fault lines between, you know, what's going to be the next major, or I guess perhaps the final major geopolitical world conflict, which is along the Pacific, right? And so I think this is straightening between the U.S. and Europe, or just an attempt to do so. And an attempt to keep Europe away from having any sort of trade deals, you know, with Russia, or have any sort of reliance on Russia. So another move that sort of moves Europe towards our side, and then, you know, pushes Russia away towards the east.
I agree. I also think that the people, I mean, even Europeans in our chat, the Brits are saying maybe now there's a perk to Brexit. but the Europeans in the chat, they already see through the whole thing. Do you think that this creates more of a rift between the governments of Europe and the people?
Well, definitely it could. I mean, especially in places like, Slovakia, whatever, who may not be all entirely on board, you know, we'll just go in full rah-rah US. But I think that I don't think the people are as interested in these sorts of team politics and alliances in the same way that the governments are. You know, people usually just want, you know, to have good prices on their consumer products and in their necessities. So as this moves along further, we'll start to see kind of a rift between the public sentiment and the state policies.
I think so too. And the interesting caveat is that they'll start supplying these weapons that will now go to Ukraine. Which is, I think, a kind of a way that MAGA can sort of deny, or memory hole, or plausible deniability that we're not really the ones sending the weapons to Ukraine. So it's the NATO countries that have already bought them from us, kind of gets Trump off the hook a little bit with the weapons supply to Ukraine. That's what they've kind of been doing anyway. They've been transferring them through Poland, but I guess they'll be more transferred ownership to the NATO countries, who will then transfer ownership to Ukraine. But
and did I also see what was it? Did Zelensky suggest about weapons production with Israel? Did you see that?
No, go ahead.
It wasn't on my agenda today, but it was something as I was researching for today. I'd seen that. Sorry, it was just a quick caveat.
Interesting axis. Maybe we can talk about it in a space later, but there is that interesting axis of the Israeli, Azerbaijan, Ukraine. And I feel like Ukraine is taking a lot of pages out of the Azerbaijani playbook to get into the good graces of Israel and Turkey. Does that kind of ring true a little bit? More so Israel than Turkey. I think Ukraine's already in pretty good standing with Turkey, but I think that Ukraine sees an in with Israel.
100%. And then they further has seen an in with Azerbaijan. As the news was rolling last week, these last 2 weeks, we saw a whole lot of smooching, we'll put that, from Azerbaijan towards Ukraine, and kind of and vice versa, I should say. And so Ukraine, you know, sees a new potential beef, you know, brewing between Azerbaijan and Russia. And so as that's been happening, they would say, hey, we very much supported Azerbaijan, you know, in its war with Armenia, or, you know, in its quest to gain back its territories and all that. So Ukraine kind of sees its Ukraine is, I don't know if it sees itself, but rhetorically it's positioning itself as in a similar position there, and as someone kind of that's been, had their feelings hurt by Russia. So they definitely are a growing axis, and you're 100% right. Israel, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Turkey, that's they all have a shared interest there.
Ukraine's kind of the odd man out there, I guess. Maybe this helps him get back into the better graces of Donald Trump a little bit. But on the topic of Ukraine and Turkey, Russia and Ukraine did meet again in Constantinople. But Istanbul, but and here's what Medinsky had to say afterwards to just so our viewers know, Medinsky was the head of the Russian delegation to Istanbul. This is his meeting or press conference after
the beginning. So this is why this we need to finalize this process first.
Я специально для господина Рютте, как большого любителя истории, приведу историческую справку.
An historical note for Mr. Rutte specifically because he's enjoying history.
В Китае была гражданская война между коммунистами и националистами.
China had a civil war between the communists and the nationalists.
Мао Цзэдун и Чан Кайши.
Чан Кайши and Мао Цзэдун.
Чан Кайши все время настаивал, что надо лично встретиться и обо всем договориться.
And Чан Кайши insisted on having a personal meeting to agree upon everything.
По-моему, в итоге раз пять встречались.
And I believe they had meeting.
Фотографировались, улыбались. Только это не привело к окончанию гражданской войны.
There was a meeting with the photographs and smiles, but this did not put an end to the civil war.
Базовые вопросы, базовые противоречия были не решены.
Since the basic contradictions and the differences were not solved.
Война продолжалась.
And the war continued.
Ну, кстати сказать, несмотря на массированную западную военную помощь, все равно националисты проиграли эту войну, победили коммунисты.
And despite the larger scale Western aid, the nationalists lost the war and the communists won.
Встреча должна быть соответствующим образом подготовлена.
A meeting.
Только тогда она имеет смысл.
A meeting.
This is in response to the Ukrainians requesting a meeting between Putin and Zelensky. And Medinsky says, didn't end the war with Mao and Chiang Kai-shek. What are your
thoughts? I love that anecdote, but... Well, I'll just one quick point. As someone who does love history, I hate when people begin there. I know as a lover of history, it's just a little personal pet peeve, but that was a great anecdote. And he's correct. And so I think that, yeah, I mean, it's necessary to reiterate, right? That we can meet every single day, 365 days a year. If we don't address the main concerns, these meetings are pointless. We're just meeting and having our photo ops, having our handshakes and our smiles. And so, yeah, I mean, to reiterate that, look, there are particular points that we're going to be hitting on or that we need addressed. And so, we don't need to be meeting if they're not addressed. So I love that story. And it's also somewhat relevant because, they're going to be going to China there on September 2nd or September 3rd for the conclusion of World War II. So very relevant anecdote there, and I thought I give that an A+ on citing that moment.
We'll let Medinsky know. The Turk gives him an A+. But here's some of his other thoughts. The third round of negotiations has concluded. Russia has confirmed that all previously agreed humanitarian arrangements were carried out in full. This is interesting. To streamline the process, Russia proposed forming three working groups to continue talks online. They don't want to meet anymore. Ukraine agreed to consider the proposal regarding groups. A political statement will be discussed and worked out first, and then a potential meeting between Putin and Zelensky could be considered. Russia made it clear to Ukraine that a meeting between the leaders must be thoroughly prepared in order for it to be even meaningful. Discussions will continue regarding draft memorandums for a possible settlement. At present, Russia and Ukraine hold sharply differing positions on these memorandums. An exchange of 250 prisoners of war from each side is being finalized. Russia has handed over 7,000 bodies of Ukrainian soldiers and received a small number of its own in return. Another round of exchanges, including involving approximately 1,200 individuals from both sides, is planned. The issue of returning civilians displaced by fighting was raised with the Ukrainian side. Russia noted that one of the previous agreements have not been fully honored. Not all civilians from the Kursk region have been returned home. Ukraine continues to hold about 30. Russia is prepared to exchange captured military personnel for these civilians. And due to the high risk from drone activity in contested zone, Russian medical teams are unable to safely evacuate the wounded. Russia is calling for the reinstatement of short humanitarian pauses along the front line to allow urgent civilian medical relief. So really nothing accomplished again.
I could suggest they could have the meeting via X Space, which you host. You could give, you'll give Zelensky co-host, and you'll give Putin the other co-host, and you'll just moderate that. I mean, might as well.
That would be so fun. We could probably get Ambassador Polyansky, but I highly doubt he'll do it with a Ukrainian official. There's other stuff going on in Ukraine as well. You kind of have a bit of a background on that, but here's a clip of what's going on.
Protesters have gathered in Ukrainian cities, angered by a hastily passed bill that weakens anti-corruption institutions. President Zelensky signed the bill late on Tuesday night as thousands demonstrated in Kyiv, Odessa, Dnipro, and Lviv. It's the first significant demonstration since the full-scale Russian invasion. Roy Chalmers reports from the protest in the capital.
This is dangerous new territory for President Zelensky. Since the war started, any frustration at his government has been muted by a sense of unity in the face of Russia's invasion. Well, that balance has just snapped. Anger at a law that would gut the independence of two anti-corruption bodies has been instant, and Ukrainians have once again come to the streets, proving that 12 years after Euromaidan, the perception of government corruption is still a raw nerve in this country.
Just as quickly he signed this law, just as quickly he should put a veto now. Because I think that with these events, he's very much losing his authority, and it's not the right time for him, for us, for the country, neither for us internally nor for us externally.
I wouldn't want the path we've been on for more than 10 years and the one we have been traveling since the beginning of the full-scale invasion to be crushed by political decisions.
It was only last week that President Zelensky reshuffled his government and appointed 39-year-old Yulia Sviridenko as prime minister. Well, it's a rocky start for her as she prepares to ask international donors for more money to keep Ukraine's war-battered economy afloat. And the EU has already expressed its disapproval at this legislation. Rory Chalons, Al Jazeera in Kyiv.
So you you know this probably even better than me. This is this is certainly not a news story, right? I mean, ever since Maidan, and then particularly since Zelensky and the SMO, there's been numerous times these kind of moves by the government that are very often justified post facto as sort of a wartime necessity. You know, we saw this with the independent Ukrainian church. We saw this it's Ukraine's like a one-party state, essentially. So I was looking into, you know, with this one, I was surprised why this one is getting so much protests in particular. And, you know, we hear the usual thing. I mean, the arguments for it are typically that it's necessary for wartime unity, that it's preventing, you know, internal divisions, and that it's a temporary measure, and it's not necessarily abolition. It's just aligning with other models and other democracies, and that it addresses potential sabotage or, you know, inefficiency in independent bodies during an existential crisis. But there's a lot of arguments against it as well, of course. It risks undoing any sort of post-2014 anti-corruption gains. I mean, certainly Zelensky came in as an anti-corruption candidate initially in the election, right? In contrast, he was supposed to be a contrast to Poroshenko. Instead, this fosters opacity and public distrust. This is seen as just a kind of a further power grab by Zelensky, and it subordinates watchdogs to, you know, the executive control and enables, you know, further abuse. So it's a consolidation of power once again. Not that, you know, there's I put much stock in this, but some people even worry that it could alienate allies and lead to aid cuts. That would be interesting, and it, you know, weakens Ukraine's geopolitical position. What do you think about this one in particular versus previous anti-corruption moments in Ukraine?
Well, what do you think about the timing? Why now? Why get rid of these anti-corruption things right now when, you know, there's been more evidence that came out of misplacing of weapons, and now I don't remember who it was. It wasn't Zelensky, maybe. I don't remember, but somebody came out and said we need over $100 billion for next year's just to run the government. So what do you think about the timing of this legislation being pushed through, kind of shoved through? There was also rumors that Zelensky kind of strong-armed a lot of the Rada into voting for this. People who were previously seen as pro-Russian were forced to vote along Zelensky's lines. The whole thing is, I didn't really pay a ton of attention to it, admittedly, but the whole thing, the timing is strange to me.
So the timing is, it kind of lines up with, sorry, I was looking up the guy's name, Shabunin. It's the Shabunin case, and it started with the charges that were announced on July 11th. And Shabunin had led the Anti-Corruption Action Center for nearly 14 years. And he faces accusations of evading military service and fraud, specifically between September 2022 and February 2023. He allegedly arranged a fake assignment from his TDF battalion to the National Agency on Corruption Prevention. And so his case is, it's seen as like a politically motivated prosecution. And so this current bill, Bill 12414, I think it coincides with that. I believe that's what you're trying to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and there's really not, and there, the only reaction we've gotten is from the EU. There's no real American reaction to this law, is there?
Right. Because once again, EU has just kind of stand pat. I mean, this is why I was kind of laughing at the idea that this could affect aid going into Ukraine, because that has not ever happened yet. And so the EU is, the EU will probably, just stand by and watch this one be pushed through as well. So it's another kind of test of Zelensky's ability to kind of thwart any norms. But yeah, I mean, that's a good point on the EU too. It's just another further thing for them to watch and do nothing for.
Yeah. And just as our viewers, so they know, and one of them actually just said it, the corruption watchdog is practically under US control. It was actually created by the US. It was NABU was created by under Obama. Obama was very involved in anti-corruption in Ukraine, or the attempt, or the act of it. I mean, they didn't do anything, but the facade was there in a way. But yeah, it was created under Obama. It's one of those things that I think Putin actually said something about it this week. There was a clip where he made a statement like, these things were Western entities anyway. So it's interesting that these things were Western entities. Now, as Zelensky, so I guess that's why the EU would react. It's the kind of, they were kind of neoliberal or liberal institutions to begin with. So getting rid of them has kind of been an affront to that sort of liberal EU institutionalization that Obama was really a big key in. That's all the important
stuff. Ukrainians go to Ukraine. Yeah.
Speaking of Ukraine, little Israel. Let's go over to big Israel, I guess, or medium Israel, or AKA the United States' alt account, Israel. This week, a lot of interesting things have come out. Let's start off with Macron. This is other Macron news, aside from him suing Candace Owens for incessantly talking about whether his wife has a penis or not. And amidst of all of that, he decided to recognize Palestine.
French President Emmanuel Macron is ramping up pressure on Israel to end its war on Hamas in Gaza. He says France will recognize Palestine as a state. On social media, Macron posted, "The urgent thing is that the war in Gaza stops and the civilian population is saved. Peace is possible." Macron says the move will be formalized at the United Nations General Assembly in September.
Why?
You know,
not that I'm against let me preface. I'm not against recognizing Palestine as a state. That's not, but why is Macron doing this?
Robin Williams, and during his stand-up, he used to have a great bit about the French, and because he used to always just kind of make fun of how the French would just kind of rub it into Americans, and it would be like, "If you make ends, I am French. I give cigarette to a baby. You're not gonna do anything. Watch." And this just kind of reminded me of that, because so France, has they always have their own kind of imperial ambitions, right? Or just their ambitions to be a big dog. They will rhetorically, they always say and do a lot of the right things, especially like the South Caucasus. I think this is a way for France to kind of make a splash. They get to almost decouple themselves from, not decouple, but just sort of do their own thing in with regards to the Western policy. And this sort of, you know, is a stopgap to the, you know, the perception of, you know, the West being all in on Israel. And so further, I think this is a way to kind of put increased pressure on the idea of a two-state solution by actually committing to something. So, you know, I mean, in a way, you know, if this is, you know, indeed something that goes through, it's great, because that is what's necessary. For if there is ever going to be a two-state solution, we need someone to actually commit to recognizing it, right? And so the some of the, like, the analysis I've been hearing or thinking about this past week, you know, France always, as I mentioned, they do, you know, when they look in the mirror, they see someone greater than what everyone else sees. And so they would like to kind of blaze their own trail or to be able to be a, you know, a competing voice, you know, on the West. And so as for the timing, I mean, as you asked, why now? Couldn't even tell you. But, you know, we're seeing the famine over there in Gaza, and perhaps this was necessary from France at this moment. But for the most part, you know, like, if I was to have to wager money on it, it's, you know, another case of the sort of this French rhetoric and not much more.
Well, I mean, there's also the French and the Israelis butting heads in Lebanon quite a bit. And, you know, there's interesting things going on in Lebanon in regards to the Syrian armed forces or the ragtag motley crew that kind of roves around Syria. And France has kind of been a little bit pokey at Israel throughout this entire thing. So I'm not that surprised, but I don't know. I think it's very milk toasty and sort of weak willed. And now you say, oh, I'll do it at the UNGA in September. It's kind of, plus all of the news that coming out this week, yesterday came out that they can't prove that, or there's no proof, no evidence that Hamas was even stealing aid to begin with, which is really interesting because Israel created an entirely new armed militia to combat the Hamas aid raid, like pirates or whatever they were. And I did write an article about it just to kind of give a background on the facts of that. It's on the Substack and it's free, but there is a new militia that Israel has started to outfit inside of Gaza to sort of combat the Hamas stealing of aid. Then it comes out yesterday that Israeli officials now admit there's no evidence Hamas systematically stole UN aid in Gaza. For nearly 2 years, Netanyahu's government has used the claim of Hamas aid theft to justify a brutal blockade and dismantle the UN-led relief system, replacing it with a privatized US-run operation guarded by armed contractors. Top IDF officials say the UN system was effective and largely resistant to Hamas interference. US intel has reached a similar conclusion. No proof of widespread Hamas theft of humanitarian aid. The new US-backed GHF, who we have talked and written extensively about, again, that's all on the Substack as well, and news stories coming out about them killing civilians daily, up to 100. The new US-backed GHF system has far fewer distribution sites and has been deadlier for civilians, with over 1,100 killed trying to access food. Former UN official of Gaza says if the UN had been taken at face value months ago, Gazans wouldn't be starving and being shot at trying to feed their families. So we have been doing this for naught. Again. We gave, what, GHF $300 million, something like that, to operate when the UN was doing it perfectly fine. This whole thing is just very spooky. And then, so then today, Israel comes out and says, well, okay, we'll pause fighting daily in parts of Gaza to allow aid because of the catastrophic hunger crisis. There's been a total blockade on Gaza since March. Israel halted all aid. And then in May is when they replaced the UN, UNRWA, with GHF. It has four sites up and running, which was all that it had planned. So four sites up and running for 2 million people. Gaza's entire population is now dependent on this aid. You guys have seen the footage of thousands of children are malnourished, and at least a dozen children have starved to death already. They attempted an airdrop yesterday, but since they could, or it was either yesterday or 2 days ago, but since they couldn't get any media coverage, they just plopped it down in the middle of nowhere in northern Gaza because no media would come and cover the airdrops. Things seem to be coming to a pretty severe head in Gaza.
You were a little bit off spaces this week, and one of the conversations was, you know, in regards to what's going to happen with the West Bank, or the likelihood that you know, Israel takes Gaza and the West Bank, or just Gaza. Not to, you know, pin you down to these words because no one knows anything for sure, but what do you think about Gaza's prospects and West Bank's prospects, and kind of just what the West wants it seems like Trump is open to hearing about a two-state solution, kind of even to the chagrin of Israel. Obviously, Israel is all the way against that. But what do you think is going on in the background right now for what Trump wants and what's going to happen?
I don't know that Trump really cares very much about Gaza. If the Palestinians approached him with a decent plan that allowed for real estate investment, I bet he would be all on board with a two-state solution. But I also think that he is indebted to and adhered to the Israeli side of this. The Knesset, I think you kind of touched on that, a push through what was the referendum this week about West Bank being annexed. Trump didn't even make a peep. They've been calling it Judea Samaria in our official documents and the Israeli official documents. Abraham Shield, which we've talked and written extensively about as well, they plan to annex Judea Samaria and give the Palestinians a little sliver of that, and Gaza to be completely under martial law. And I think that Trump is okay with that.
So you think Israel's going to be just get get the whole table?
Who's going to push back?
Yeah.
Only the people that can push back are the Gulf Arabs, I would think, in this scenario. Mm-hmm. I think Saudi's doing a bit of that. Because Saudi has to have that sort of balancing act with its people. But
and
I don't
governments think like any, France.
Yeah, I don't think there's really any political will to save the
country. Yeah, one thing I forgot to mention on France. So similar to the Caucasus, you know, France has a large Armenian diaspora, so they always make, mm-hmm. you know, sort of these rhetorical nods to Armenia. Similarly here, this France has a large Muslim population. This was a way mm-hmm. for Macron to kind of harbor some domestic support there and you know, act like he's doing the right thing, but it's mostly just kind of hot air. But yeah, that was an important point I forgot to mention.
Also in the news today is, also in the news today is the air defense issues. So finally coming out and admitting it, the 12-day war has really depleted the stocks. There's an alarming gap in U.S. missiles, the American missile stockpile. So during the 20 June conflict, the U.S. deployed 2 THAADs, thermal high altitude area defense systems, to Israel, firing over 150 interceptors, nearly 25% of the Pentagon's total inventory since 2010. The pace of use was so severe that the U.S. considered redirecting Saudi Arabia's THAAD supply to Israel. The war strained not only THAAD stocks, but also Navy SM-3 interceptor missiles, with 80 missiles fired from destroyers. Concerns have emerged about the effectiveness of the SM-3s and the lack of the system reloading at sea, creating a major vulnerability for future conflicts. Key points: THAAD interceptors cost $13 million each, with only 650 purchased and fulfilled to date. Navy destroyers in the Mediterranean and Red Sea fired interceptors at unsustainable rates. Israel nearly ran out of Arrow 3 munitions. Voice-based deconfliction between U.S. and Israeli systems led to inefficiencies. The Pentagon now acknowledges deep stockpile shortfalls and the urgent need for a ramp-up in missile production. An estimated cost to replenish THAAD interceptors, $2 billion.
You know, remember in the Cold War, the amount of weapons that sort of went around the world just through all those conflicts, and even by the time the Cold War ended, these weapons, you know, found themselves in the hands of various entities. I can only imagine, and you know weapons, you know, better than I do, the amount of weapons between Russia, Ukraine, and Israel, and all these other conflicts. by the end of all this, the amount of terrorist groups, freedom fighters, mafias that are going to have their hands on these like written off and stolen munitions and arms and really high end tech, you know, as you just described there, far more high end than we were seeing in the Cold War. And so even once these conflicts end, there's a whole lot of people and a whole lot of, you know, bad entities that have been armed or will be armed through the course of this. It's insane. So, yeah, I mean, I can't even think of what the number is that's, you know, of the missing stockpiles.
Well, huge. It's huge. I just started writing a very lengthy article. I sent it to Mr. Kaplan for editing about this, about a fifth column forming in the EU of Ukrainians, as well as the weapons leakage. And I think you're right. And I wanted to ask you if you think if it's a feature or if it's a bug. Sometimes these weapons leakages, like in the case of Pakistan, Afghanistan, they were kind of turned a blind eye to on purpose. I'm wondering if that's sort of the instance. Now, we found them as far out as the Sahel. So they're all the way down into Western and Central Africa. And they're with terrorist groups who are fighting Russians, which makes me think that it's more of a feature than a bug.
Yeah, like I'm inclined to call it a feature because, you know, similarly, like here in America, we like the idea, you know, firearms of being armed. And this will, having arms find its way to people that otherwise wouldn't have it, in a way gives them some power. It doesn't leave them powerless in the face of, you know, any state actors or anyone they may need to fight against. So it's dangerous. You know, there are going to be people who die. There's going to be bloodshed, you know, due to the fact that these weapons are out there. But overall, kind of philosophically, I do think it's a feature.
I do, too. That's another reason why. And that kind of brings us back to the anti-corruption thing as well. I don't think that the Americans don't care if the anti-corruption thing is gone, because it's advantageous for all of this sort of black market issue. I mean, they found the weapons in Gaza. They found them in Turkey, in Syria. They're everywhere. These weapons are everywhere. I think they've even been found with cartels down in Latin and South America. So very, very interesting.
Actors that I'm imagining is going to be getting these weapons out.
It's wild how widespread they are. And, you know, we don't get a lot of reports about what's going on in Europe, but I imagine all of our brothers and sisters in Eastern Europe and the Balkans probably have their hands, and Poland probably have their hands on some very interesting weapons by now. Very interesting weapons. So exactly that. And I think that that's important to keep in the back of your mind as we move forward and we're having more political turmoil within Europe and the Levant, especially. Speaking of political turmoil, I'm going to try to do this right. Please forgive me. Give me some grace. I'm learning with all of you guys about this very, very, very fascinating, very ancient Thailand-Cambodia conflict that we've kind of been talking about since about February, here and there, border skirmishes, border issues. So I don't even know where to start. I guess a good place to start is to talk about what is going on. So there are two temple complexes that are currently under dispute, and as well as two other sites there. These are four ancient sites, Khmer sites, if you know anything about Khmer Hinduism. I believe one of them is to the god Shiva. I'm not sure whom the other one is to. All of these temples belong to Cambodia, and they exist along the border with Thailand. As Thailand's population grows and they encroach in on these temples, more and more of these border skirmishes start to occur. So the first dispute started over the Tamwen Tom Temple, which is another Khmer Hindu temple. And then that was why the Thai F-16s took off. We did see some footage, some really amazing footage out of Cambodia. How many find this guy? He doesn't even look behind him when he fires the RPG. No shirt, no sandals, no nothing, no nada. This is such a, that's Cambodian soldier, by the way. This is such a Southeast Asian war. It's like Thrilla in Manila, Rumble in the Jungle. It's so fascinating. Thankfully, not many civilians have died. I think it's below 50, so that's reassuring. And I actually don't think there's very many troop casualties either. The very, very interesting battle. Very interesting. They're very outmatched, which is another important thing to remember. So there's, this is the most accurate I could come up with through my own research. There are other charts floating around, but this is the one that is the most accurate from Global Firepower at the end of 2024. So as you can see, while they do rate Cambodia as more powerful on the power index, their global rank is much further lower than Thailand. And Thailand being backed up by the United States is important. I did speak to Brian Berletic earlier today. Well, he commented on one of my posts stating that there's a rift between the Thai government and its military. The military is no longer really backed by the United States. But we also love the Thai military because they have war elephants. This is like the greatest war ever. Like, I'm a little bit of a war junkie, I get it. But, like, this is so, like, fascinating. It's just an incredibly, like, Bronze Age sort of war happening over temples and border disputes. Obviously, the borders were drawn by France. But another important facet to this is the Pan-Asian Railway. All roads lead to China. So here you can see China has been building this enormous Southeast Asia railway to counter the United States kind of semi-blockade in the South China Sea. It also makes transport much easier. The Laos line is currently open. That central line has been transporting people since 2024. There's another line that was stalled by Japan. If you want to say that's the Eastern route, and the Western route is another Chinese endeavor. So if you look at the map, you can see that Bangkok becomes a huge hub for all of these railway projects. So I'm kind of theorizing that it's possible that this sort of conflict and destabilization negatively impacts the ASEAN countries in terms of their relations with China is kind of what I'm gathering from all of this, sort of.
I'm so glad we had the clip with the elephant. I was wondering if you'd include it because I think this might be the first use of them since Hannibal Barca
invaded
the Roman Empire with them. I saw someone put in the comments, so that's how an elephant would wear pants. I was thinking the same thing. I don't know how they got the camo on the elephant. It's very cute. But you're right. I mean, this comes down to, fractures of the former French colonial possessions. Essentially, this is once again, this is a matter of how borders are drawn, in the aftermath of colonial empires. I know you were researching the story. It seems like this is mostly a conflict between the Thailand's Shinawatra family, led by the suspended prime minister. Their names are really hard.
You don't even try.
Khan Shinawatra and Cambodia's Hun clan, which is under the prime minister Hun Manet. These dynasties were dominant for decades, and they used to share business ties and political alliances. And then a leaked phone call, details of which remain murky, but reportedly involving some border concessions or insults. Yes. They fueled some personal animosities, and now it's turned the dispute into an open conflict.
Yes. So this is the I'm not going to try either, but the first prime minister, the female all the way to the left, she's the one who made the phone call. And in the phone call, the Thai perceived it as her giving concessions to the Cambodians in terms of the border areas. She was then suspended. And this guy in the middle named Suraya Jungkrianchkit. And he started acting as prime minister, and then he was suspended, and the guy on the right is now currently the acting PM Phom Tham Wachaya Chai. Wachaya Chai. Yeah, I think that's how you say it. So those are those. There's a ton of political turmoil just in Thailand alone. And then you mentioned Hun Manet, which is in Cambodia. His father was also the leader of Cambodia, and he has leftover ambitions as well. This is kind of like Bush Jr., Bush Sr. type stuff. So there's a little bit of that.
Dynasty families, yeah, in essence. And so they've had control of both of these countries for decades. And in Thailand, you have the leadership vacuum amid Pyongtarn's suspension has amplified nationalist rhetoric to consolidate power. So, yeah, I mean, I look at this, I look at the war footage. I'm getting nostalgia. Well, I shouldn't say nostalgia, but it's reminding me almost of the Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter. You're getting more Southeast Asian war. But yeah, I mean, as we were kind of touching on in Spaces this week, there's of course, you know, broader alliances here. Thailand is kind of in the NATO camp. Cambodia has always been somewhat upheld by, you know, on from China. Mm-hmm. Right. And so once again, this is, you know, another front, you know, in the larger chessboard. And so we'll kind of keep an eye on that. But interestingly for me, Russian state media, barely a peep about this.
Really?
Not much. I mean, they're just kind of probably waiting and seeing what happens, but they're not giving much airtime to it at all.
Well, they don't really have any allyship in that region, like nothing incredibly strong. I mean, they support Cambodia because Cambodia is supported by DPRK and China. But from what I'm gathering from talking to my Chinese friends is that there's something else there. Something's not right about Cambodia because they keep saying things like Cambodia is so corrupt. Cambodia is a lost cause. Cambodia is kind of gone. This very antagonistic towards Cambodia. I think I really need to go in there and really dig into like Laos, Cambodia, Thailand. There's this area called the Emerald Triangle that the three of them fight over. They've been fighting. There were some rumors about Laotian fire being exchanged. So that it's a really interesting area. And like you said, colonial map drawing. I am working on an article about this to the best that I can. And I did include a colonial map. It's important to know, because just like we have issues in Levant, thank you to Sykes-Picot and all of the other debacles given to them by the West, these borders were drawn by the French. It was French Indochina before this whole entire area was sort of divided. So France is responsible for this sort of border issue. Again, we've talked about these manufactured fault lines, and I'm going to recommend that everybody read Clash of Civilizations, even though Sam Huntington is an American political scientist. I do suggest you read it. Talks about this manufactured fault lines along religious and ethnic grounds. This is really important because he even predicted, and I'm seeing this come to fruition, he predicted that once the wars of ideology, i.e. the Cold War, communism versus liberalism, whatever you want to call it, communism versus capitalism, once those wars of ideology have dissipated, we will start to get into wars of civilization, which is ethnic division, religious division, linguistic divisions, stuff, historical divisions, stuff along those lines. So I think that's a really important read. You probably find it for free online because it's a very popular book, Clash of Civilizations by Samuel Huntington. So here's a little bit of a timeline. If you guys can read this, just so you guys get a general idea of what has gone on. This has started in February. Cambodians tried to sing the Cambodian national anthem at a temple, and they were stopped by Thai soldiers, which created a domino effect. A border clash occurred in May where one Cambodian soldier was killed. There were some meetings in between that. And then in early June, Thailand announced their ready and willingness to actually go in and do a military operation. They had agreed to withdraw in June, but then recently a Thai soldier was killed by a mine in the area, and that created another kind of storm. Trump, our wonderful peace lover in chief, I think the Thailand one was first. So I've just spoken to the acting prime minister of Thailand, and it was a very good conversation. Thailand, like Cambodia, wants to have an immediate ceasefire and peace. I am now going to relay this message back to the prime minister of Cambodia. After speaking to both parties, ceasefire, peace, prosperity seems to be natural. We will soon see. And then he replies again, I just had a very good call with the Prime Minister of Cambodia and informed him of my discussions with Thailand. Both parties are looking for an immediate ceasefire and peace. They are also looking to get back to the trading table with the United States, which we think is inappropriate to do until such time as the fighting stops. You get it now? You get it now? They're going to strengthen trading relations with both of these countries to push China out. China is moving like hectotons of freight along that China-Laos line. They've moved 34 million passengers and like 40 million tons of freight over that rail line. So it's very important to know that Trump will not resume trade. Well, the trade has been stopped because of the tariff situation, but this is all kind of included in that. This is tied into that sort of, they're not going to get a good trade deal if they don't adhere to my ceasefire, that sort of thing.
And I was kind of foreshadowing this earlier when I was saying how, you know, the global fault line is moving towards the Pacific and in kind of away from where we've been used to in the Middle East and Eastern Europe. And now we kind of see, you know, as we try to encroach into East Asia and Southeast Asia along the Pacific. Now, you know, these are the sort of incursions that we see. Of course, Trump, hilariously, very quick to pat himself on the back for having brokered a peace deal. We enjoy the Truth Socials, you know, where he celebrates, negotiating the ceasefire or whatnot. So, of course, you know, this is, you know, one more feather in his cap for the Nobel Peace Prize pursuit. He had a truth that didn't get as many retweets, but he also brokered a peace between the Bloods and the Crips, by the way, the Hatfields and the McCoys, and the Groypers and the Baptists. So he's stopping every single war everywhere. And
he can't stop the MAGA Civil War, though. He can't stop the MAGA War.
Yeah, no, he cannot be stopped. That's obviously a joke, but that might be a segment I start doing on here is fake Trump Truth Social posts.
I think we should. By the way, there's no ceasefire. Thailand started taking as much territory today as it could. It just started claiming all kinds of territory along the border and then said, we'll meet with you guys tomorrow. So they're going to have peace talks tomorrow. I guess we'll see how they pan out. I don't know. China's inaction aggravates me at times. Usually I understand it. I feel like this was something that they should not have let even get to the point of Trump posting on Truth Social. This is their backyard. This is their Monroe Doctrine. This is their sphere of influence. This was their time to step in and really put their foot down because this is their trade route. I mean, I'll show you once again. Here's another chart of it. I mean, this thing is massive. And not only that, but they tried to get other countries to help out with it and they failed. And China just took up their projects. So all of these countries that couldn't even compete had to drop out of the project. India was forced to make their own separate highway because they couldn't afford to do the project and they're retarded. Sorry, you guys can't get anything done in India. It's the truth. It's like, so they had to give up their line. They'll say, oh, we'll build a rail. We'll build a highway. So it's very interesting that, and Trump mentions trade. So I think that's the most important part. Dan said Palantir is all in Thailand too. So I guess that just gives me another rabbit hole to jump down and write another article. Thank you, Dan. But that's interesting to know. Interesting. Very interesting. I don't want to say I like this war. I find it very interesting. I'm very fascinated by this war. And I think people need to pay attention to these sort of not as technologically advanced wars. I mean, we saw Russia, Ukraine, which in terms of technology wasn't really that cutting edge. I mean, the drones were great. Then we get into Southeast Asia where they're using like ancient weapons, no armor, nothing. And, you know, like this is like real warfare. You see this stuff in Syria, too. You see it in the Sahel. People are used to like seeing America go in and bomb the Houthis and then leave. And that's a war. People don't realize like this is what it really is.
Yeah, and another thing, you know, to from kind of broader Asian news is Trump, once again, in his kind of bipolar Asian policies, he's once again kind of hedging to Pakistan, and then this leaves India the ability to fall back into their non-aligned comfort zone and reach back out to China. But yeah, Trump is perhaps by that Nobel Peace Prize nomination, but he did this Pakistan outreach, and this leaves Modi back once again back in the middle. I always do respect India's non-aligned policy, and I do think that they are big enough and they're coming in a way that they can afford to do that. They don't really need to sort of fall around a great power. But yeah, I mean, Trump is just helping them do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Pakistan-India thing was such a debacle. And I thought that that whole scenario actually made Trump look very stupid. And Modi came out on top of that. Trump was saying, I had to broker a peace deal. And Modi straight up was like, no, you didn't. And so I guess this whole area, you think that Trump's just kind of like in the land of delusion? Like, he's like, I'm orchestrating all of this. And really it would have happened whether he was there or not.
I mean, there is delusion there, but there's also some of that like kind of false bravado, because he's used to like just sort of lying and puffing himself up. So I think part of it is also just rhetoric. I don't think he's fully delusional about the fact that he's BSing here. But yeah, I mean, the way that he will want to portray himself is that he's, you know, super active and involved and doing all these things. But essentially, this is just a whole lot of status quo and a whole lot of nothing.
And I'll just leave you guys with this. See, now another commenter says that Cambodia is close to the U.S. It's highly possible that the U.S. is supporting Cambodia. That's also possible. These Southeast Asian alliances are very fluctuating and kind of weak. And this might also serve that purpose to kind of force Cambodia and Thailand to like pick a side. In Trump's world, you can't be America and China. You got to have one or the other. In China's world, you can do both. In Trump's world, you cannot. So this might also be sort of forcing the hand of both of these countries to sort of get off the pot and make a decision.
Right.
I think that's all I've got in me for today, though.
That's all I got in me as well. But a good episode. That was a good episode.
Thank you all for watching. I know the weather is beautiful, so maybe guys could share the stream so people can watch it later. And we will be back again, I think, next week. I have to check the calendar. We should be back on Sunday right before our trip to the Middle East. So we will see you guys on Sunday live, and I'll try to go into some more spaces this week and learn more about Cambodia and Thailand. Any final thoughts, Murat?
I think that was everything I had. Please don't start any new wars, world. Thank you.
Start more wars. Have a good week, everybody.